As we come to this fourth chapter, he begins to open again some of the struggles in his own heart, the things he had been through, but he begins to tell us now at least what some of his perspectives were in the midst of his own suffering. And again, this letter is remarkable if you read through it, to hear Paul opening his heart, talking about his doubts, his shortcomings, his failures, his prayers, his requesting God for things that it seemed that God wasn't giving him, how he made plans to come to Corinth from Ephesus, then he changed his plan to go to Corinth and to Macedonia, and from Macedonia back to Corinth and then Jerusalem, and how that didn't work. You know, just the honesty he's giving us, how he prayed about these things, thought they were the Lord, and yet they didn't work out. Just the struggles that he had, like many of us often, thinking that God is doing something and then discovering, well, it wasn't the Lord at all. I'm glad to hear that Paul went through those things. I don't feel so alone. Well, here in verse 8, he's describing some of his struggles again, and he's going to put them in perspective of eternity for us in this chapter. He says, "We are troubled on every side, yet not distressed." That's hard for me to relate to, by the way, because normally when I'm troubled on every side, I'm distressed. "We were troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed." I like that, because so am I so much at the time. "But not in despair," the word there is "not without help. We are persecuted, but not forsaken." And I think sometimes when I'm persecuted, I think, "Lord, what are you doing?" You know. "We are cast down, but not destroyed. And we're always bearing about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our body." Of course, Paul, remarkable life, remarkable struggles, remarkable physical pain in his ministry as we follow his life. "We which live are always delivered unto death for Jesus' sake, that the life also of Jesus might be made manifest in our mortal flesh. So then, death worketh in us, but life in you. And we, having the same spirit of faith, according as it is written, I believed," he's quoting David, "and therefore have I spoken. We also believe, and therefore we speak, knowing that he which raised up the Lord Jesus," and he's keeping the resurrection in view, "shall raise up us also by Jesus, and shall present us with you." Now, I like the fact that Jude adds in there that now unto him who is able to present us faultless. That's an important word for me personally. I'm looking forward to not just being presented before the Lord's throne, because I could be sweating a little bit about that. But I like the idea of being presented faultless before his throne in glory with exceeding joy, by the way. I think even our guardian angels in that day are going to go, "Phew, am I glad this job is over." You know, so there will be exceeding joy in that day as we are presented faultless before his throne. Now, incredible that is. If you look back at your life, you look back to yesterday, as a matter of fact, it'll amaze you. You don't have to look back that far, that we're going to be presented faultless before his throne. Paul is keeping that in view here as he is writing to these Corinthians. You know, it's interesting to hear this man, and I think he serves with the zeal he does because Jesus said, "Whom is forgiven the most would love him the most." And of course, Paul is the man that made the church blaspheme the name of Jesus and destroyed families and persecuted the church, and yet found that Christ, his bloodshed was sufficient even for Paul's sins, and that he was brought into the ministry and given a particular place to serve Christ and became a mouthpiece for the resurrection and for the church and the reality of the church. And again, he is the man who develops the word grace for us in the New Testament, 120 times from Paul, only 7 times from John in all of his writings. The word grace is used, and I think twice in Peter's epistles, but Paul is the man of grace. And because of the tremendous grace that was extended to him, and he's a man who's looking forward to standing before the throne of God someday. Important to all of us. Now he says in verse 15, "For all things are for your sakes, that the abundant grace might, through the thanksgiving of many, redound unto the glory of God. For which cause, for the glory of God, for that day, we faint not. And though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. So Paul begins to tell us at least part of what drove him. I think part of it was his love, of course, and his appreciation for Christ. He said the love of Christ constrains us. But the other part of what drove him was his perspective of life and eternity. And he talks about that here. And the first thing he tells us is, he says, look, we know that this temporal house, in verse 16, we faint not, though our outward man perishes. The Greek is continually is in the process of decaying. Hate to think yourself like that, don't you? Yet the inward man is renewed day by day. So the inevitable, of course, Paul, at this point in his age, was quite aware of the inevitable. That is the decay of the physical body. When you can look backward in your life further than you can see forward, you're aware of it by that time. I think that, you know, in my teens and in my 20s, probably maybe even in, up to 30, 31, I really didn't think much about decay. I felt in pretty good shape. I could run myself ragged and keep going and eat junk food and stay alive. And, you know, but you get to that point where the inevitable starts to dawn on you, where you have to work much harder to convince yourself that you're still young against odds. I think, you know, even at my age, some of the folks that I hang around in the early 40s, you can tell you're getting there, because now if you bring something up, somebody says, oh, I have a specialist that, you know, or I have, you know, this doctor. Oh, let me give you this guy's. Now, you went there. No wonder. That guy's a jerk. You should try this guy. No, when my prostrate, you know, and this and that, you know, and you, and when part of the fellowship becomes exchanging phone numbers of valuable doctors, you know, that you know that you're getting there. Oh, the staff's good there, but the beds are dirty. Or though the beds are great there, but the doctors know what they're doing. You know, you want some place where the bed's comfortable, the food's good, and the doctors know what they're doing. The inevitable comes to us. And I think in America, we're working very hard, of course, to escape that between face lifts and scalp lifts and cheek lifts and nose lifts and liposuction and the remarkable prices that people are paying. We're making plastic surgeons into millionaires, and they have a valuable craft for those who can afford it, to make us look much better than we really are. But Paul, at this point in his life, of course, is admitting that we are in a process of decay, the outward man. He's not going to the health spa. He didn't buy a juicer. I did. And then you spend a lot of time trying to convince yourself that carrot juice tastes good. You know, you put apples in with it or something, it still tastes like carrots. No supplements. And I think, of course, America is handing us so many alternatives, and the alternatives have moved down. When I was 13 years old, I was in the Boy Scouts working towards an Eagle, trying to become an Eagle Scout. Kids that are 13 now are sexually active. They've already experimented with drugs and alcohol. You know, the things that life may hand us to deceive us about what life is really about have moved way down the scale to now we have to worry about our kids in elementary school learning about alternative lifestyles as though there's such a thing that's acceptable in regards to daddy and daddy and mommy instead of mommy and daddy. I mean, that we've really moved it all down, all the things in this life that appeal to the flesh that would deceive, because that's not what life is about at all. I think it's inevitable as we grow older to reevaluate. But I think that even here, the truth is life can be gone like that. Spending last year in Israel with Chuck Samuels, we roomed together, and then here at the church, walked out, saw him getting on a motorcycle. I said, "Is that yours?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "You're crazy." I said, "My cousin was killed last month on a motorcycle. You're crazy." I said, "Drive carefully." He laughed, and 3 hours later, he was with the Lord. You know, it can just go like that. Again, I remember years ago reading about a guy downtown that the guy that was killed in a barber chair. The bus hit a fire plug, snapped it off at the surface, it spun down almost a half a block, jumped through the window, killed a guy getting his hair cut in a barber chair. Life has always got to be kept in perspective. And Paul says, look, the outward man is decaying. That's just the process. It's in the continual process of decay. And for Paul, it wasn't just physical, I'm sure. Because he says the renewal he's speaking of is the inward man being renewed day by day. Now, I like to hear about that because it reminds me that that's the only way I'm going to receive renewal is day by day. The children of Israel had to go collect their manna every day. They couldn't collect enough for a week or for 2 days. Jesus taught us to pray, and he taught us to pray, "Give us this day our daily bread." The idea is that we might be dependent upon you again tomorrow. And I think sometimes we may look at somebody like Paul, you know, here's a guy who killed Christians, who slaughtered the church, who broke up families, you know. We might look at somebody, you know, says, "I was in the Hell's Angels," or, "I was a heroin addict, and I did this, and I murdered people, and I had needles broken off of my arm, and, you know, whatever, and choked my dog," you know, somebody, you know, and then we hear they got saved and think, man, they really got saved. You know, I kind of warmed my way into the kingdom, you know. I was raised in a Christian family or something. That guy really, he's really saved. And when he got saved, he really got saved. Man, I probably need to go out and get worse before I can really get saved. You know, but Paul, and look, if we look at a dramatic conversion, I don't know anybody more dramatic than Paul. On the road to Emmaus, Christ appears to him. Even the soldiers see the light. The voice speaks to him. He talks back to the Lord. There's a conversation. He's blind from 3 days for the light. You know, I don't know anybody who had a more remarkable conversion. And yet, Paul didn't receive enough juice then in conversion to carry him the rest of his Christian experience. What he's saying to us here is I find a necessarily there has to be daily renewal in my life. I think by the time Paul went to bed at night, as we follow him, he faced sickness. We know he had eye problems. There's some indications he may have had malaria that was rampant in the northern part of the Mediterranean then as he traveled through Phrygia, Pamphylia, and came up to the plateau where Galatia was there. He faced tremendous hardships. I think every day when Paul laid down his head, he was physically, emotionally, and spiritually exhausted. I think he was out of juice by the time he laid down at night. When he got to lay down, he said there were nights he went without sleep, fastings and prayer, watchings through the night. And I think it's an encouraging thing to realize that if Paul the Apostle, this giant of faith, needed to find renewal every single day to go onward. Because that's the only way it's going to come to you and it's going to come to me. We're not going to get it charged up enough on Monday to carry us all week. That's baloney. Our relationship with Christ is on a daily basis. And I think he wants it that way, by the way. It wouldn't be enough for me to talk to my kids. You know, if you have your devotionals a half hour every morning, you can't have 2.5 hours of devotion on Monday and expect that's going to keep you till Saturday. That's not the way it works. I can't talk to my kids for 2 hours on Monday and think, gee, I don't have to talk to them again until the weekend now. Paul tells us that inwardly, not outwardly, because that was decaying. There was the hardship of this world, the physical world around us. But inwardly, in the midst of all the things he went through, he was finding renewal day by day. And he begins to describe to us how that takes place. I think the first thing he wants to establish in our minds is it has to take place on a daily basis. It's important for us to realize every day we've got to seek the Lord. Every day we've got to be in his word. Every day we've got to find his presence. Every day we have to look for him. That has to happen daily. He says in verse 17, now our light affliction, and he's certainly got a different perspective than most of us. Our light affliction, which is but for a moment, and in Romans he said that the present sufferings are not worthy to be compared with the glory that's going to be revealed. Here he says, our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us. And I think that's part of his perspective. A far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. The idea is, what he's saying here, our present afflictions, the things we're going through right now, that are momentary in comparison with eternity, and that's what he's going to tell us in the next verse that he keeps in perspective, that they work for us. You see, when I look at my affliction, my hardship, however it comes, I really don't look at it as working for me. I look at it as working against me. Because I usually have my own agenda and hardship is not included. And he says these things are working for us. Now when he says they're momentary, obviously he has eternity in view. Now again, when we hear about Demas in 2 Timothy, as Paul is signing off, he says, Demas hath forsaken me, having loved this present world. Again, that is, i.e., in light of the world to come, having loved this present world. And again, Demas was without excuse. He couldn't say, well, I didn't have good teaching. He was with Paul. He couldn't say, well, my church wasn't charismatic enough. Paul was raising the dead, healing the sick. He couldn't say, well, his teaching was off, or the guy was, here's a guy without excuse. The idea is it's just the natural inclination of the heart to be attached to this present world. And that's what he says about Demas. And here, Paul, in perspective, says, this affliction is but for a moment. Obviously, life can be a momentary thing unless you're weighing it in light of eternity. And that's what he's saying. It's working for us a far more an eternal weight of glory. There's some eternal glory. The idea is the weight of it is not worthy to be compared with what's happening right now. And he says, so these present afflictions are working for us. Now, look. That's easy for me to say this morning. Again, I don't know what all of you are going through. There's probably some folks that are involved with our church and not even here this morning. They're so heartbroken. They probably got up this morning and said, I don't want to hear it. I want to hear the Bible this morning. I don't want to hear about Jesus this morning. I'm just tired. I'm tired of trying to figure out what God is doing. If he has the power to do it, why doesn't he change this? Why doesn't he cut me a break? They're not sitting home saying, gee, this is all working for my good. But Paul says they work for us. They do several things, I think. Affliction, hardship, when it comes, it certainly helps us keep this life in perspective in regards to how temporary it is. And the Bible says it's like a vapor, it's like a dream. It's here today and it's going tomorrow. And I could probably have a dozen people here, over 60, stand up and tell you that life's been like a dream. They can't believe it's passed already. It certainly provides an opportunity for God to work the afflictions. They work for us in that sense that he demonstrates something when we are out of our own resources that we haven't seen about him before. It certainly works for us in the sense that it provides an opportunity for those around us who love us and care about us to see us endure hardship and still talk about Christ and still talk about our faith. It certainly blows their minds. It works for us in the sense sometimes it gives the church an opportunity to come to our aid. I mean, we took care of over 100 families the other day, and it was so neat to see the guys coming back that volunteered to deliver saying, this is the greatest thing, getting to play Santa Claus. I mean, we're going to these people's homes, they're crying, they're thanking us, they were coming back blubbering, So those things do work for us. I would rather not have them work for me now, a little later, but the idea is they work for us, he says, a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. And he begins to tell us how that happens here as we look at it. He says, while we look, that's the important phrase, not at the things that are seen, but at the things which are not seen, for the things which are seen are temporal, and the things which are not seen are eternal. Now, there's a play on words here. He says, while we look, he uses the word, the Greek word for look there is scopio. We get telescope, microscope, scope out, whatever you want to say. Not the toothpaste, though. It means to bring something into focus, to set your attention upon something and examine it, to come to a conclusion, to determine something by examining the facts. A microscope brings things into focus. A telescope brings into focus. He said, while we look not at the things that are seen, and that's a different word. That's important. That's blepo. It means a lot to you, doesn't it? Well, it means something just like it sounds, blepo. For the things that are blepoed are temporal, but the things that are not blepoed, things that are not seen, are eternal. The idea is the things that are seen, it means a glance. It means you just look at them. They're right there in front of you. You don't have to work at it. See, that's the world that's around us. It's smacking us in the face every day. It's seen. All you got to do is open your eyes and MTV's in front of you. All you got to do is open your eyes and you see the billboard. All you got to do is open your eyes and you see what Satan has said around us. You don't have to work at it. You have to work at not blepoing it. My problem's not blepoing it. My problem's not blepoing it. Isn't it yours? And it's the temporal that invades us. You know, it's the temporal when you wake up in the morning and your kid's puking and he's got a fever and you got to go to the doctor and you get a flat on the way to the doctor's and then he's throwing up in the car. And then you get to the doctor and you realize you left your checkbook at home. Then you run out of gas on the way home and he throws up again. You know those days, you know, where you feel like just driving over a cliff, you know, I just go home to be with the Lord and taking you with me. You made me miserable all day, you know. The idea is the temporal invades us. The life circumstances come upon us, and many times, uninvited, unexpected, painful. And we don't really have to work at those things. They're there. They're in front of us. All we have to do is glance, and we see the temporal world. That's why it's so hard for us. Jesus said, anything that we give away now, we're going to receive 100-fold. It's hard to make the trade, because he's asking us to trade away something that we got for something that we can't see, that we have to believe in. And from the time we're little, you know, you can see the sinful nature in a little baby with a rattle. I mean, the first thing that kid learns to say is, mine. And if you want to get that rattle away, you got to give him something he wants more. Give me that. Ah! You know, and you're in a restaurant, you don't want everybody to look at you. So you hold up something that's shinier, and then he goes, takes that, and you get the other thing away from him. And from the time we're born, we're caught up with this world. How can I get pleasure in this world? How can I get fulfillment in this world? You know, how can I get what I want in this world? I want to date this guy. I want to date this girl. I want to have this car. I want to have this career. And you can see with your eyes how people prosper. You can see what you think success is. You can see what you think beautiful is. You can see what you think pleasure is. And you don't have to work at it. You just blepo it. All you got to do is glance at it. But the things that are eternal are not that way. You can't blepo on them right now. You won't get them by blepoing them. You're going to get them by scopio in them. That's what Paul says. I scopio them. I have examined them. I have milled over them in my heart. I have thought about and meditated upon the streets of gold and the walls of jewels. I keep in focus that there's a day coming when the Lord himself will descend with a shout, with the voice of the archangel and the trump of God, and we'll be caught up in his presence. I always remember there's a day coming when he's going to wipe away every tear from our eyes and he's going to walk in our midst. I always keep in focus there's a day of reunion. And some of us are looking forward to seeing parents or spouses. Some of us are looking forward to hear the hurried footsteps of a little child running to jump in our arms again. And Paul says, you know, it's while I set my heart on those things, I examine them, I have determined they are worth more than the things that are around me in this world. It's in that, while we look, that the things that are happening to us now work for us. It's while we look that we're renewed day by day, and that renewal won't take place without that perspective. Paul says, it's while we look at the things that are eternal that I can say, though I'm troubled, I'm not distressed. And though I'm perplexed, I'm not without help. And though I'm persecuted, I know I'm not forsaken. Though I cast down, I know I'm not destroyed. It tells us Abraham by faith sojourned in a land of promise and as in a strange country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the promise, because he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And these all died in faith, not having received the promise, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them and embraced them. Those are the promises of God. We see them afar off, we become persuaded of them, and we embrace them. That's what Paul did. And let me tell you something. You see, the trick is when you start to hit 35, 40, 45, 50, 60, it's much easier to let go of what you're convinced of by then you're not going to hold on to and start to embrace the things that you're starting to believe more than ever that you'll never lose. But the problem is, for us, most of us are younger than that. The problem of that is there's still a lot of deception around us. The problem is, in many ways, for you teenagers here, if 85 or 90% of the conversions to Christ in the United States take place before the age of 18, then Satan's greatest desire is to stagnate the church that's under 18. That makes us yesterday's church, by the way, and you kids that are under 18, it makes you today's church and tomorrow's church. And you are the ones that this world's goods are being heaped upon to stagnate you as much as possible. Paul says of Abraham that he saw the promises of God afar off, he was persuaded of them, and he embraced them. And confess that they were strangers and pilgrims in the earth. For they say such things, they declare plainly that they're from another country. But now they desire a better country, that is a heavenly one. Because of that, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Because they see God's promises afar off, because they become persuaded of them and embrace them. Because of that, God says, I'm not ashamed to be called their God, because they're believing what I say. It tells us Moses, by faith, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. He esteemed the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, because he had respect for the reward. And by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, but enduring as seeing he who was invisible. Job tells us, in the midst of his sufferings, and you can imagine, of course, the things that he was going through. His children were dead, taken away, all of his earthly belongings. All had been stripped away from him. Of course, Satan in his genius left his wife next to him saying, curse God and die, curse God and die, you know. And Job, in the midst of his complaint, is given a revelation, a glimpse, a glimmer of the eternal. And of course he says, oh, that my words were written in a book. Now, he didn't know we'd be here reading his book this morning. Oh, that my words were written in a book, that they were printed upon a page, that they were carved with a chisel in a rock forever. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand in the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms have destroyed this body, hard to look at yourself as worm food, isn't it? All that investment in the spa and exercising and getting that worm food in shape. Yeah, it keeps life in perspective. And you know the way they are down there, the bigger the better, you know. They don't want somebody lean and mean coming down there. They're hungry. After my skin, worms destroy this body. Yet in my flesh, I will see God, whom I will see for myself. My eyes shall behold him and not another, though my reins be consumed within me. Job realized in the middle of his suffering, you know, we believe in a God who's risen. We believe in a Messiah who has licked death and left it in the dust. We believe in one who beat the rap of death and has come back to life again. And because he did that, those of us who believe are going to do the same thing. And he said, I know that in the latter day, that's the days we're living in, that he's going to stand upon the earth. In fact, as Zechariah tells us, he's going to touch down on the Mount of Olives.
And that we're going to see him eye to eye and face to face in our flesh, which will be resurrected and changed. Not another. Even though Job's body was consumed thousands of years ago by became dust. Now, the thing is, the world that's around us is a blepo world. We look at it, we face it every day, we don't have to work at it, it smacks us in the face, it draws our affections, it tries to take us away from Christ, it presents alternatives to us, it lies to us, it deceives us, it presents everything that's going on around us as more important than it really is, it gets us to set our hearts on the things around us, that we get disappointed when our idols are taken away from us. But Paul says the affliction, the hardships, this temporary pressure we may be under can work for us. And it works for us in the sense that it causes us, and we probably wouldn't because of the way we were, without pressure, but God allows it to come, that we bring true life into perspective. And Paul says, in that, though the outward man is perishing through the hardship of life, we're discovering that inwardly we're renewed every day. That takes place, he says, while we look. Now, I encourage you, those of you who lost children, those of you who feel like you want to throw the towel in and quit, those of you who are widows or widowers now, send somebody ahead. Become a student of prophecy. Start to look at the promises of God about the age that is about to break on this world. And it's not the new age Shirley MacLaine is talking about either. Start to set your heart on the description of that city. Start to look at Revelation 4 and 5 and 21 and 22. Become familiar with it. Let it be part of your thinking. Weigh the things that presently bother you against those things. Now, see, you can't blepo those things. We think that we can get them off Christian videos or Christian television shows. You got to get alone with the Lord. You got to get alone with his word, and you have to examine those things and mill over them and meditate upon them. And when you do that, God will start to bring them into focus. Paul says, while we look, while we scopio, let's telescope it, let's microscope it, let's scope it out, let's bring it into focus, let's become familiar with it, let's know it so much, and let the Spirit, it says, I have not seen, ear hath not heard, neither has entered in the mind of man the things that God has prepared for those who love him, but his Spirit has made those things known to us. Let God's Spirit begin to interpret those things to our heart, that our affections become set on those things rather than the nonsense we see around us. And in that, there will be a daily process of renewal, because there will always be something to weigh against the world we blepo. Because you can blepo, glance at, easily see the physical world, but you cannot blepo the eternal world. You have to scope it out. You have to study it out. You have to mill over it and meditate upon it and set your affections on it. And it will become your sustaining strength through whatever God is allowing you to pass through, whatever deep valley, whatever comes your way in this life. If you can weigh against the present, the future, and the future is heavier on the scales than the present, you will be kept and renewed.